reflect on that still suffering alcoholic inside and outside the rooms and their family members? Thank you. Thanks again to the speakers and Rangi for chairing. We're going to take probably a little 5-minute break and we'll be back with our final.
You can all hear me, give me a wave. Should be okay. Thank you. I would like to just start this session off with the serenity prayer if everyone wants to pray along. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. We did just have a moment of silence at the end of the last session, which was only a couple of minutes ago, for the still sick and suffering alcoholic and family member in and out of the rooms. So I will move right into introducing our final speaker for the weekend. It is Larry, a very good friend of ours from Bellflower in California. Damien and I had the good fortune of having Larry and his beautiful wife at home last year, or the year before. I can't even remember what year it is. And honestly, you would never meet such a beautiful, down-to-earth man, and it is my great pleasure to introduce him to close out as the last speaker. Larry, over to you. You there, Larry?
Yes, ma'am. How are you?
You're unmuted. Where's your video? I can't see your face.
How's that?
There he is.
Hi, everybody. My name's Larry Thomas, and I'm an alcoholic. Can you hear me all right? Yeah? I want to thank you guys for the invitation, and it was kind of surprising because last week when I was talking to Damien, we'd been talking about that great meeting that he has in his front room, his sponsorship meeting, and I was all set to poke my head in there, and that's where I thought I was poking my head in tonight till I seen that menu that he shot me of everybody else coming in. I thought, my God, that's gonna be a packed house. But I'm glad to be here, and my lovely wife, thanks you. We've been quarantined for the past couple days, and I get a little cagey, and but she's good with animals, and she kind of talks to me like a German Shepherd. You know what I mean? You know, get off the couch. What are you eating? What's on your nose? Go outside. You know, but. Anyway, I'm glad to be with you guys, and it's always good to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, no matter how they come my way. And what's been happening to me lately is I've seen us get back to basics in AA, you know, and I hope we remember this when this time passes. My sponsor tells me that I am living proof that a man can stay sober for close to 38 years and not amount to a damn thing. So if you're new in AA, I don't know what you think you're going to happen here, but the highest I've gotten here is sober basic human being, active member of my own home group. And I'm a very proud member of the Bellflower Big Book group and have been for 36 years. And if there's anything that gives me hope in life, it's being in the middle of a home group. That's where I found the power that I was going to need to sustain, you know. And I'm thankful for that group and the people in it and the sponsor and everything. And I come from good people, you know. I don't come from bad people or anything like that. I was born in Detroit. And I come out to California when I was about 4 years old. I was in a foster home and then an orphanage for a while. And my mom and dad had some problems. And so they sent me out here, and you know, my mom was a sweet lady. I love my mom to death, and she was a hardworking lady, and she was also born in Michigan, and she liked diet pills is what she did. She loved to eat. She loved speed. So she was always running around the house around midnight, sorting out nuts and bolts all night, or raking in the neighbor's yard early in the morning, you know. And just a busy lady. And she was always, you know, when you eat that speed, she always had, you know, she liked to make Afghans. So she was up all night making Afghans and spent days making Afghans. And, you know, couches had Afghans, chairs had Afghans. My dad's golf clubs had little poodle heads. And no matter what time you got up, she was up doing something, you know. And you know, we had a real small house at the time, and we didn't have a lot of room, but you could always hear her in this little room knitting all night, just, you know, like a knitting machine all night long. But, and you know, as some of you know, when you eat a lot of speed, you have a lot of hobbies, and one of her favorite, and you like to do them all at once, you know, you're painting, you're mowing, you're doing all kinds of stuff, you know, and her favorite hobby was to eat that speed and make these big jigsaw puzzles, not the 30,000 piecers or the, you know, 100,000 piecers, but the million piecers, you know, of the Mojave Desert. And this would excite her, you know. She'd run down to the drugstore and get her prescription filled and get her carton of cigarettes, you know, and get some blonde peroxide she'd take home, and she'd come home and put that little one and only Moo on she had for 50 years and squeeze in the old breakfast nook and make these damn puzzles all night. And heck, if she got a piece that didn't fit, well, she had a big pair of toenail clippers and she just clipped that little thing and wedge it right in there, you know. And I loved being around my mom because I could avoid my dad, you know. My dad was a happy drunk. My dad was a happy singing the blues and Nat King Cole Bobby Darin drunk. And he was a refinery worker, so he was, you know, you never knew when he was coming home. But, you know, he used to get drunk and sneak into his own home, which is an amazing thing. One of the things I picked up from him, and he was a hostile man when he was sober, but he was just a great guy to be with when he was drunk. And I caught that. That caught my eye. I knew he found something, and I could see the drastic change in him, you know. And, you know, being a refinery worker, he was always coming in and out of his house all day long. And, you know, one day he came home from work and he snuck into my bedroom window, you know, and I felt this big refinery boot on my chest. So I grabbed that boot and I said, "Hey, you know, why don't you have mom make you a set of keys? You know, my God, she's up anyway. I can hear, you know, I can hear vacuuming now, you know." And, but me and my dad were always butting heads, because through my inventory with you guys, I found out that both of these folks worked very hard. They came from nothing. And, my mom was thrown into a Catholic orphanage when she was 9 and got out when she was 14. And my dad was brought up in the streets of Detroit. And his father died when he was very young, choked on his tongue. And his mother hung herself in a Detroit jail. She was a drunken whore. And his dream was to marry my mom. And both of them would work so hard. And he would join the Navy. And both of them would move to California and have 2 and 3 jobs. And they would work so hard for so long, just so their children would never have to live through a depression or poverty. And they did a heck of a job. However, here I would sit in this house with this sense of entitlement that because I'm somebody's son, I deserve everything that comes my way without lifting a finger, just because I'm there. This would be a defect that follows me into Alcoholics Anonymous and all through my life, all through job, everything, the sense of entitlement, just because I want to get sober in AA, just as long as I'm sitting in that seat, I don't have to do anything that you folks are doing just to get a little bit of peace, you know? And boy, my dad was fed up with me. My book talks about having these childhood fears and ideas about a power greater than yourself or God. And all these childish conceptions that I have, I remember very well because I got them at a young age and they stuck with me. You know, like I said, my mom was in that convent from 9 to 13, and they, Catholic convict, and they did bad things to her. And I connected that with God. My baby brother died when I was 5 at birth, you know, and I thought, what kind of God would create a baby and kill it? And I connected that with God, and so on and so forth. So I thought this whole thing about God was just a bunch of nonsense. And I had this idea at a very young age that it was up to me to figure this stuff out, because I couldn't trust my parents, even though they were hard workers. I'm kind of one of those kids that I have to be led by example. And there were some situations where it was like they told you to do something, yet they weren't doing it. And just a lot of things that confused me as a kid. And I didn't know who to talk to. So it started this idea of secrecy and guilt. And armed with that as a child, and would not be telling my mother and father things that were happening to me in the neighborhood at a young age. And I learned to keep these secrets and keep these guilt and drag them into my adult years. You know, I started running away from home at an early age because I was ashamed of myself. You know, I didn't trust the people that I was, you know, was loving. And, I started running away from home at an early age, and anywhere would be safe as long as it wasn't in my home, you know. And I started drinking at an early age. For me, I started drinking at about 11. Nobody had to dare me, or nobody had to pay me to do it. There was me and four of my friends went across the street and into this guy's garage, and we started passing around a bottle of Four Rose whiskey. And for the first time in my life, this little loser, this nobody, became a somebody. And even though it was just temporary, it was top of the world for me, because it was something that I wasn't getting when I wasn't drinking. And something that alcohol did for me was something that I couldn't find in everyday living, what everybody else was getting. And it was that sense of well-being the book talks about, that sense of ease and comfort that it seems like people around me are just walking with, you know, and I'm spending my whole life fighting to feel good, constantly needing pep talks, constantly needing this extra boost to get along and join groups and get out of, you know, and I spent most of my time in a tree fort, for God's sake, you know, tree fort and Dirty Magazine, which, you know, to this day, I love a good tree fort. And I had a bottle of Four Rose whiskey, and Jesus, I never laughed so hard my entire life. I never threw up so much my entire life. And that evening, I remember, kissing my first Latin woman, and it was my aunt. And she was 46, I was 11, you know, I counted it, you know, made my uncle a little edgy having me around the house, you know. But like I said, for a brief moment, for a couple hours, a little nobody was somebody, and it turned howdy doody into James Dean and a couple drinks. And I marked that spot. Now, I didn't run out the next day and, you know, quit my paper out and head out to Skid Row, you know, and come to AA, like some of us at 11, you know, but I did mark that spot. I had a secret weapon, and I love secrets, and this was my secret. This was something that I knew I would be leaning on for a long time. And it, you know, like I said, I didn't start hitting the bars and stuff like that, but I knew I knew whenever it, what it did though, it fired off an obsession with me at an early age that when all else fails, man, I could go out to the garage and get a shot of the old man's Thunderbird, get a shot of the old man's PM bourbon, you know? And, I had that constant thought growing up since then about this lingering notion of getting drunk. And, you know, the older I got, the more I did it, you know, constantly getting kicked out of school and stuff like that and getting in trouble was going to be a regular part of my life, you know, and the worry that I would start putting on my mother and father, I never want to forget. And I couldn't. I remember my mom telling me and my father telling me, well, if you love us, why do you do this? And what they don't know, it was because I love them that it was killing me, because I knew I would have to do it because I didn't know how to stop. You know, I didn't know that I lacked the power to stop, you know. And, you know, it started getting me in trouble at an early age. And I just began to live with that trouble. It was part of the deal, you know. It was better than hard work and good fortune, you know. For a loser like me, I'd found my secret to life. And, you know, I remember being a freshman in high school and the kids were going to their locker rooms to get their books and their notebooks. And I'm going to my locker room to get me a little shot of Thunderbird wine and a couple barbiturate pills and, you know, stuff like that. And I started dating this little Mexican girl and she had a couple brothers and they liked cars and I love cars to this day. I have these big Dodge trucks like they do up in Washington where you drive over each other's house and shit, you know. But I did have a lowered 64 Chevy, you know, and I had my hair up real big like a Bakersfield tumbleweed. And we'd drive around and drink that cheap wine and listen to the Four Tops and the Temptations and the OJs and Marvin Gaye. And God, I loved it. Had our cars all lowered down, you know, and driving around drinking that wine with our frowns on our face because our asses hurt and driving around all night, you know. And I loved it. And I was somebody, you know. I was somebody. I was Lawrence of Torrance, for God's sakes. Nobody else knew that, but I knew that. And that's all it took. And I hung around those guys and I loved those guys. And I was set for life. You know, everything I wanted, I'd find in the back seat of that car, you know. And the older I got, the more trouble I got into, and going in and out of jail and all that became a part of life, and doing heroin and stuff like that. And, around 1969, everybody's going places, and doing things, and, you know, around this time in my life, my parents are afraid of me. I introduced my mother and father into a level of living that they never knew existed, and it proceeded to rub their face in. See, I never want to forget meeting you guys. And you guys, May 2nd, 1982, I finally stayed for which I hope and pray is the last time. And I remember getting with you guys and you'd take me to a book study and you'd introduce me to a sponsor. And we would start on this fact-finding process. And I would start going back and writing this four steps. And I'd write things about Larry that I dragged in when I was a kid up until my age of 30 when I came in. One of these things is what I would do with people. And one of these things I would do with people is what I would do if you gave me love and attention and affection. And what I would do with that charming gift to me is I would play you like a fiddle. That there would never be a time too old or an age too old or a time too inconvenient for me not to put the tap on my mother. My mom was on top of that list, and I played her like a fiddle. And it wasn't just for a lost weekend or one summer. The older I got, the more I did it. I never want to forget at the ripe old age of 17 being locked up for a while, and they finally brought us home and they dropped us off in front of the courthouse. And I was supposed to run in the courthouse and I ran into the neighborhood. And that was on a Monday and I come out on a Thursday. and I don't show up and go to home, and I don't show up and go to the courthouse. What I do is I show up in a parking lot at 8 o'clock in the morning, a parking lot where my dear mother is working. She's working at a dry cleaner's, and on the weekends she's cleaning people's houses, and I'm ashamed of her and I make fun of her. But I'm not too ashamed to show up unannounced at this little dry cleaner's at 8 o'clock in the morning with my drunken filth and my mud and my disgust and my blood and what Wino Joe used to call the habiliments of despair. And I'm standing there, she's about 50 yards from me, and I'm in the parking lot and it rains all over me. And I look down at my feet and I don't have any shoes. And I got what we have when we're losing. And that's nothing but the clothes we own. And it's got all that puke and blood on there. And I'm walking through that rain and I duck behind a car and I'm waiting for that last customer to come out of my mom's place in business so I can go in there and make the move on him. And I open up that glass door to the dry cleaners and that brass bell hits that glass. And my mom turns around and makes that old folks so familiar sound. Oh my God, Larry, where have you been? And she would go grab her wallet and she would peel off $1 and $2. And I would run by and grab that money and run off to a little city called Wilmington, California, where I was to die. I never want to forget that. Now the thing that brings it home to me this afternoon, Monday over there in Australia, is this. You take this same man in Alcoholics Anonymous, new, willing to go to any length, desperate. And I need to ask that new guy something. How come if you were to put the secretary of a meeting half that distance of me in the parking lot, how come I can't walk that distance and ask the secretary for a job and a meeting that's going to save my life, and make no mistake, it will. But I can walk that distance and use my mom and folks like her time and time and time again. And I'm here to share with you, if you're new, that if my alcoholism doesn't kill me, my selfishness and my self-centeredness will, make no mistake about that. That's why it's necessary for a man with close to 38 years to have a home group and a routine of meetings all week long and a job in every one of them. And it's not so I could zoom into Australia and tell you the good news. It's for one reason and one reason only. I will never get so sober that I can't get drunk again. But I can get so drunk that I can't make it back. And I never want to forget that. I never want to forget what I used to be like and what's happened and what I'm like today. I never want to forget that. I never want to forget all the times I went in and out of AA with this sense of entitlement. I never want to forget that. And if I can start serving the thing that's saving my life and find the defects that keep me from serving more, I will have found the key to life. Because the moment that I started serving something that I wanted so much from, I couldn't help but keep it in every area of my life. There's a miracle here. Things happen to you and me here. And it's not about finding AA. It's not about finding God for people like me. How are you going to serve them? Are you waiting for something to happen to you? And then you'll do something? See, I'm a something for nothing guy. You're reading my mail. And that's what happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I never want to forget that. But in 1969, people are going all over the world. People are going to Vietnam. Some people are turning hippies and stuff. And in 1969, I grabbed one of my guys and I thought, you know, let's bounce off from Los Angeles to Detroit and go find my roots. So we bounced off to Detroit and wound up in Phoenix, for God's sake, which was only 300 miles, you know, and up there on Skid Row in Phoenix off of North Central and Roosevelt at the Apache Hotel, you know, and everybody's got a, you know, everybody's got a TV in their, you know, a TV and it's in the lobby and everybody's got a bathroom and it's down the hall. it's $35 for the rent every week, and I'm running low on dough, and I don't know what to do. I'm scared to leave my room during the day, and I'm afraid to be with me at night. So I find this little bar down the street called the Wagon Wheel Bar. And the Wagon Wheel is a great bar. I love a good bar. And it has no windows, just a dirty curtain blowing in and out of it, you know. And I go in there and I hide out in there and I meet a guy named Ernie. You know, every bar has an Ernie. You know, Ernie's the answer man. If you got a problem, Ernie's got the answer, you know. And he said, I know what we're going to do. He said, not too far from here. You know, I got a buddy, he's a plumber. He'll come by in the morning and he'll put you to work. So I come by in the morning and I've never plumbed anything in my damn life, you know, but I do like being in your house. I don't care if it's under it, in the attic. I love being in your home, you know. And so Ernie took me out to the desert, stuck me underneath the house, and he says, gave me a transistor radio. And he said, all I want you to do, son, is hang this copper. That's all I want you to do under there. He said, I'll come back and get you in 8 hours. And he took off, and I'm underneath this house. Love being underneath the house, you know. And I start crawling around there, you know, and I see this stray cat, you know, and I go, my God, I thought I got it made. I never had it so good, man. I got a transistor radio. I got a pint. I got a pet. I got all these three things going. And, you know, this is a big deal in my life, man. So I started drinking some of that hot bourbon underneath that house. You know, I had a pint. 9 hours later, they're dragging me out from underneath that house. Apparently, I got drunk and busted up through the lady's floor, and I robbed her of her jewelry and some of her money, and they're dragging me out of the house, and this cat comes walking out with a bunch of necklaces, you know, put me in jail for 2 months. I get back out and go back to the Wagon Wheel, and Ernie says, I know what we're going to do. I know what we're going to do. Not too far from here is a horse track. We're going to get you down to 95 pounds. You're going to be a jockey. And I thought, great, man, to get to start working out and stuff, you know. And he says, well, I don't know about this. He says, but, I'm going to have to get you down to 95 pounds. And I got some of this. And he had a little, you know, a little baggie, what he's talking about. He says, I want you to take this stuff in about 2 months. We'll get you down to 95 pounds and we'll take you to the racetrack and, you know, get you to be a jockey, you know. And I thought, oh, this is great, man, you know. And so he left me with this speed, and I don't do speed. I've just been drinking cheap wine and doing heroin, minding my own business, you know. I'm not going to be no Afghan maker like mom, you know. And so he takes off, and he comes back 2 weeks. 2 weeks he comes back. It wasn't no 2 months. He comes knocking on my little rattly door in 2 weeks, you know. And I've been taking that stuff, and I haven't moved an inch. I'm just buzzing around my room and chasing a fly around my room and looking out my window every 10 seconds going, what's that? What's that? What's that? You know, or I'm hiding underneath my bed, you know, because there's these black and white flashes that keep happening and it's scaring me, and it's the sun going up and down, you know, and my God, it's got a face on it, you know. He knocks on that door and he says, you couldn't have possibly taken all that stuff. And I said, well, I did, damn it, you know, and put a saddle on me and ride me around here, you know. So that was one of the first 28 days of my life. And anyway, I went back and I found another plumber to work for. And this kid was, you know, I started working for this kid for about 2 hours, and it dawned on me that he was younger than me. And I ain't working for no kid. So I did what any honorable man would do. I faked a knee injury, and they took me to the county hospital. And the doctor wrote me a prescription for Percodan. And then he left a room, and he left an empty cardboard box full of prescription pads he wanted me to have. So I grabbed that thing, man, running down North Central, you know, and ducked into the old Wagon Wheel Bar. And Ernie looked at these things. He goes, oh, my God, this is fantastic. This is fantastic. And he makes a phone call to some guy in Southern Arizona, Yuma or something. And, man, we start writing prescriptions. We start writing prescriptions for everything. Secanol and Nebutol and Tylenol, you name it all. We wrote it all, you know, and damn near took it all, too. And after about 9 months, they caught up with me and it was an easy catch, you know. There was no big helicopter over the freeway going, there he goes now. You know, I was going 9 miles an hour, you know, and the cop was on foot. He just hey, come on, Isaac, pounding on my window, just walking alongside, you know. And they arrested me and sent me to jail for a little over a year. And I get out of there and come back to California in 1973. I'm out there and I'm in downtown Torrance at this old hotel. I think it's called the Roy Tan Hotel down there. And probation department puts me on Anabuse in 1973. No AA, nothing like that. They just put me on this Anabuse stuff. And after 2 months, I'm in this little room and I get a job offer from my probation department to go down to a refinery where I'm going to be a janitor part-time at midnight. And so I'm not driving. I'm not going to drive till I'm 33. So I take the bus and, you know, it's 2 or 3 hours. And I get there 2 or 3 hours early and I start walking around this little town of El Segundo, California. And it's the first time since I'm 13 that I don't have anything in my system, no alcohol, nothing. I'm a little over 2 months without anything. And I go into this dugout and I got about 3 hours before that little job interview and I start pacing that little dugout. And I sit in that dugout and I start rocking. I start thinking about me and the old man. Start thinking about me and my dad playing baseball catch. And then I start thinking about my mom and I start crying like a baby. Then I start laughing like a clown. And this goes on for a long time. And then this paranoia comes over me that I never want to forget. And I'm used to being paranoid, but it was a floating paranoia. This one stuck. And these hallucinations started to happen. And they're used to floating around and these stuck. And I began to say what they called somewhat catatonic. And somebody calls the paramedics and they come and get me. And they take me over to the Harbor Central, Harbor General Hospital in Carson, California. And in 1973, I'm on a gurney with an arm and a leg on a little bed. And the doctor comes by me with a little piece of paper. And he says, son, by the way you've been lived in the past couple years, he says, I believe you need to go to a state hospital and be observed for 30 or 60 days, son. And they put me in a little van, a little 3-hour drive over the hill, and they sent me to a state facility to be observed for 30 or 60 days. And a year later, they let me out, totally observed. And they gave me certain medications to take that'll help some of my problems. And they were convinced that my past was my problem. And they did everything they could to try to get rid of it. And a year later, they let me out of there. And they had me on certain medications. And after about 2 months, I ran out of Thorazine. And within a couple of weeks, they found me downtown Los Angeles, across the street from Alvaro Street at a Chevron gas station, laying on a pile of tires, 120 pounds. And I wasn't over there vaping. You see, that's where we live. Because I lack the power to do anything but that. I don't know how not to drink, even when I want to. Given any reasonable excuse. I have that alcoholic torture that they talk about. I have that alcoholism that frustrates the hell out of therapists and doctors and psychologists because they can't talk you out of it. They've got all the information. They've got booklets. They've got pictures. They've got data. They got all kinds of stuff trying to convince you that you're an alcoholic. And nobody can talk me into being an alcoholic. It's a place where you drink yourself to. That alcoholic torture that me and you suffer when we're sober, that every time we're not drinking, we know what we did last week and the years and the days. We're kept up all night with the nightmares of things we do. And every time we're not drinking, we know the people we hurt and who've hurt us. And every time we're not drinking, we know the people who are praying and hoping that we don't drink. We see the little kids, we see the bosses, we see the loved ones, everybody. but something happened to me when me and you stopped drinking. After a couple of days, the desperation wears off. After a couple of months, the desperation wears off. And if I don't replace that desperation with inspiration, I'm a dead man, and I don't have that in my life. So the only thing that not drinking has ever squeezed out of my head is that damn little idea that this time it's going to be different. But it doesn't come to me in those words. It comes to me in a vocabulary that I've grown up with since I was five. The three most deadliest words in my mind. What's the use? What's the use, Larry? What's the use, man? You ain't gonna make it. You're a nothing. You'll always be a nothing. And I'm off and running. Because I lack the power not to. And I know I'm gonna do it again. And again and again. And they find me on these bag of tires over there, like I said, in Alvaro Street. And they send me up the wayside where I'm going to do 3.5 years in a state penitentiary. And I've got out-of-state forgeries. And I've got a public nuisance. And after about 40 days, they get about 60 of us on a black and white bus, drive us down 20 miles to a courthouse in Torrance, California. And I'm in a holding tank about the size of somebody's garage. And there's about 40 of us in there. And one by one, the judge is calling us out. And all these guys are leaving. They're going places. And at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm the only one left. I'm on a concrete floor with a bonds bag and no hope, wondering where they're going to send me now. And at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I hear music. And it's the sound of keys. Coming down the hall, and they roll open this jail door. I'll never forget it. It was an olive green jail door, and there at the door of a jail, shiny with a smile just like Evie, was a Scottish man with a patch standing there. And he says, "Aye, lad." He says, "Are you Larry Thomas?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I am." He says, "That's great. Come with me, son. We're going to AA. My name is Alex." And I said, my God, what's AA? And who's this Scottish pirate all of a sudden? You know, what the hell, you know? That, you know? And looking back, well over, I mean, I've heard, you know, I didn't know what AA was. I've heard of all kinds of AA, you know, and OR and PO, but what's AA, you know? And looking back, well over 40 some years, I know exactly what this guy was. I knew exactly who he was. Because there's a handful of folks over there that I know that are just like him. There's a handful of folks you've probably had all weekend long that are just like him. And my home group is sprinkled with them. My life has been dusted with them. And they're what my book calls a trusted servant. And what made this man a trusted servant was simply this. He had no business being there. He wasn't on a panel. He wasn't a probation officer. He wasn't a counselor. He wasn't a doctor, a lawyer. He was a refinery worker. And he just got the worst news of his life. And that news was that his wife was dying immediately. And he knew she was in good hands, but he knew he wasn't. But somewhere in his home group, somewhere in his book study, in a sponsorship meeting in a man's living room on Monday, somewhere in a 12-on-12 in a guy's church on Wednesday, somewhere in a book study at 5:30, that man was to sit with you folks in that book and grasp and develop a manner of living that ingrained it in this. That practical experience tells us that nothing would ensure immunity from drinking but intensive work with other alcoholics. This works when other activities fail. That's the thought that came through his head. He didn't think of milk and whiskey, Damien. He didn't think of milk and whiskey, Darren. He didn't think of milk and whiskey. The thought had been removed, just like it had been removed in Towns Hospital with Bill Wilson laying on that bed in his high school. He just didn't lay there and have an experience. His high school buddy came by, Ebby, and he took him through the proposals. And Bill had this blinding flash. This sudden, spectacular thing happened to Bill. One that I thought that I was supposed to have. Frustrated me for 5 years and that I didn't have that. And I kept thinking I did something wrong. Why can't I have the kabumi? And then I would sit with you in your book study. And I would read that chapter over and over. Then one day me and my friend Mac were sitting in the book study and we're reading it. Two paragraphs down, after that man's laying in the bed having the kabumi. Two paragraphs down, laying in that same pieced end bed, this man who had the thought of God has this other thought. Maybe I should work with other alcoholics. He didn't say, maybe I should work with everybody. Maybe I should work. Now, there wasn't even an AA yet. And he's thinking, maybe I should work with other alcoholics. How many of you had that thought your first day sober? Me neither. But maybe, just maybe, the thing that happened to Bill suddenly, he's hoping will happen to me and you gradually, but the end game is the same. We're carrying this message to other alcoholics. We're carrying this message. Not because our sponsor's hammering us, not because we're threatened to, because we've been inspired to. Desperation to inspiration to perpetuation, the most beautiful triangle me and you will ever know. There's stuff to do here, baby. He's hoping something happens to you so that you can carry the message. That's our job, finally a primary purpose. And I had no idea what was going on with me. And that man took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1975. He threw me in his car. And I'm waiting for a long ride up north and maybe some lunch or something, right? He goes for a 15-minute car ride to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Goes into this dingy, stinky, rotten, filthy, pukey, perverted Torrance Lamita Alano Club. And I thought, oh my God, what's an Alano? You never heard of something like that. Is that like a moose or an elk, you know? And it's a AA clubhouse, so to speak, you know? And I go in there, and he starts introducing me to all these goofy people, man, you know, Indian Genie and Captain Bob and Tennessee Bill and Singing Sam and Serenity Sam and Bicycle Ray, Santa Claus Ray, Dancing Pete, Whistling Butt. My God, I just love it's like that. You know, little Moose was 120 years old. She's running across the parking lot, you know. Hi, my name is Moose, and I'm expecting a miracle. I said, my God, I bet you are. Said, I'm not it, you know. And then this big transvestite, man, he starts circling me like a helicopter in Sydney, you know. And after about three times around, he lands and he says, hey, he says, I can't wait to take you to our candlelight meeting. And I said, my God, I don't think so, big guy, you know. Not until I get a year anyway, you know. And I thought, man, if this is AA, I don't want any part of this. And from 1975 to 1982, I went in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, which was the biggest lie I've ever told myself. I never touched AA. I did what I've been doing my entire life, sitting in a room waiting for somebody to do something for me. I've had my hand out my entire life. And I would sit in these meetings. And these newcomers would sit next to me and I'd give them a nudge. Get out while you can. AA don't work. AA don't work for me. AA don't work for me. And as I sit before you in the old Zoom room, I'm here to tell you that after 37 years, I've made the miraculous discovery that AA doesn't work for me. Doesn't work for Damien. Doesn't work for Darren. Doesn't work for some of my friends that were here. We work for it. You need to wrap your head around that. That is going to be your saving grace. Your saving grace. I am proud to be a part of a legacy in Alcoholics Anonymous that started with a man named Norm and Chuck and so on to my sponsor, Johnny. And it's been ingrained in me this, that there is one answer to all problems. Working with another drunk. Trust God, clean house, and work with others. Put all your efforts into staying sober, Johnny told me, and the rest of your life will take care of itself. But the more you start peckering around your personal life, and that becomes more important than your primary purpose. Adios, kid. Adios. And every time I called Alcoholics Anonymous, somebody would come and get me. And they were always clean, and they were sharp, and they were shaved. And that's why I'm wearing a tie right now. It's not because of him. Because of you. You taught me about respect. You taught me about having respect for the thing that's saving my life. And if I can respect my home group and the meetings and the people in it, maybe just maybe I'll be able to take that home to my beautiful wife. Maybe just maybe I can take it to the boss. Starts here. Starts right here. Amazing thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. And on May 2nd, 1982, I was at the Beacon Heights Mission in downtown Wilmington. 120 pounds in yellow, handful of cards, people's numbers and stuff like that. And every time I would call somebody, most of the time I'd get this bald-headed carpenter named Don. And I walked by this Woolworth window, out of booze and out of ideas. And I went by this Woolworth window and I seen the thing. I seen the thing who was 120 pounds in yellow. And I looked at the thing, and it's the first time I'd seen myself in a reflection for many, many years. And I don't look at myself. I crack mirrors. I don't want to look at myself. The disgust, I used to scar myself because I couldn't stand who I was. And I caught eyes with this thing. And I said, my God, whatever happened to my dreams? And it dawned on me, I never had any dreams. Because the moment that I would think about maybe becoming or doing something, that thought of, what's the use? You'll never amount to nothing. You ain't got what it takes. And I'm off and running because I'm a nobody. And I was a couple days without drinking, and I'd been DTing. And I came to believe. I made a call to this man. And I called that club and I said, is Don there? And they said, yeah, he is. And I said, so they give me the phone. I said, Don, this is Larry. I'm down here at the Beacon Light Mission. Will you come and get me? I'm ready to come back to AA. And he told me the most profound of my life. He said, no. He said, you know where we are. You know what we've got. Why don't you get your rusty rear down here yourself? I'm tired of chasing after you. And he hung up, and I thought, my God, whatever happened to that AA love, you know? And I just heard it for the first time in my life. It was up to me to come to you. It was no longer necessary for the good people of Alcoholics Anonymous to come and get me. And I went around the corner, and I came to believe. And I didn't come to believe in God. I didn't come to believe in your book. I didn't come to believe in your meetings. I came to believe in the hopelessness and the futility of my life with me running the show. I knew it would never get any better. I knew my life would always be like this. The torture of my life is I wouldn't die. And the energy that I used to use when I would feel that way to fling off the drinking, I was able to reverse the thrust and run it to you. And I took the longest walk of my life. At 10 miles, and I asked the man a question I never asked anybody in my life. I said, Don, I don't know what to do with my life. Would you be my sponsor? And when I was humbled at that moment, I believe for the first time I recognized me rubbing shoulders with a power greater than myself. Though I didn't know it at that time, I totally believe that's the gift of surrender. when we can finally rub shoulders with a power greater than myself. I couldn't start believing in God until I started giving credit to the thing that deserved it. And once I started showing credit and giving credit to everything that's happened to me, I slowly began to believe in a power greater than myself. Because I knew when I was with you that I was safe. And that's what I love about my home group in Bellflower. That's where I found a power greater than myself. Because it appeared to me that in my case, that the more I served you, the clearer he became. And it became so clear and so evident that today I know that he loves me. Today I know that I got a God that loves me. And I never thought that that would happen to me. I spent 30 years trying to prove he didn't exist. And then it dawned on me 10 years ago that he had to be there in order for me to prove he wasn't. What a beautiful thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. Now I want to tell you about the most beautiful 12-step call I ever made. 3 weeks ago, my sponsor, Johnny, he founded our group. Coming up on 60 years sober in his late 80s. He never Zoomed a meeting before. And so I got to take my sponsor who founded our group over to my house and get them all plugged into a computer and Zoom into a meeting. And I was so afraid he wasn't gonna like it. And the meeting started. And he's looking in there and you can see the people and stuff like that. And my sponsor is in a meeting for the first time on the Zoom thing. And I knew he wasn't going to like it. And I was so afraid my sponsor was not going to like these meetings. And then they introduced the speaker and my sponsor said, "Oh, shit." And I said, "Oh, my God, it's just like Monday night, man. He's here. He loves it, you know." And eventually he began to like the speaker and the meeting and everything. And he was at home and he's been Zooming ever since. Oh, how I love my sponsor dearly. He taught me and is still teaching me everything there is to do about being with you, that there is a power greater than yourself. And I always get it when I'm with you. Thank you.